I do think it said so much that people from Trolley Guy to Sisto who tried to prevent something or tried to help and not run away said so much about our city.
With these endless inquiries that keep being thrown at the ABC, with the rounds of budget cut after budget cut and the sniping and the complaints going on endlessly, it's just an outrage to me and shows a deep insensitivity to how highly regarded the ABC is.
Did a journalist really actually inspect your hair, Ruth?
Absolutely she did. The killer tomato.
I think you've got lovely hair.
Oh, thank you, Caroline.
I did that once to Phyllis Diller because she was actually wearing a wig. She made a comment about the wig and I said, oh, that's your real hair. And she said, honey, come and touch it. And I pulled it and I almost pulled the wig off. So.
What has happened to our society that it's too much of an effort to vote on actual election day?
We know that you're Kerry O'Brien, you know, the hard-hitting political interviewer, but these were such tender moments. That change of pace when you had the opportunity, what did that afford you as a journalist?
Well, for a start, they were the things that kept me sane and kept me going at 7:30 for longer than I otherwise might have. And the reason I called it real celebrity is because there is so much bullshit celebrity in the world.
Don't Shoot the Messenger podcast with Caroline Wilson and Corey Perkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Don't Shoot the Messenger, a weekly podcast of news, views and reviews and general chit-chat with me, Corey Perkin, and my very good friend, journalist and new kitchen owner and queen of the Scrabble board, Caroline Wilson. Hi, Caro.
I've got a particularly good curry recipe for you this week, Corey, later on, but excitingly, we have another guest this week and another book as well.
Oh, we're so delighted. Before we introduce our special guest, we've got a lot to discuss on the show, so stick with us, potties. Crazy days at the ABC, Caro. Of course, last week's tragic attack in Bourke Street. As you said, you have a recipe, I have a telly show, and our special guest has a crush or indeed a non-crush of the week. Speaking of our guest, Caro and I are joined today by one of Australia's finest journalists, a man who has won 6 Walkley Awards over his impressive and eventful 50-year career. He is a father of 6, grandfather of many. He is a recent sea changer, and now he is the author of a new autobiography. Welcome to Don't Shoot the Messenger, Kerry O'Brien.
Corey, thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you. Congratulations on a memoir, which is just gets to the point, really, doesn't it, it's typical journalistic fashion.
Well, that was more the publishers. I was with my wife, Sue. I was trying to come up with something really clever and slightly mysterious, and they just kept bringing me back to basics, which was that most people walking into bookshops want to glance at the cover of a book and work out what it is.
Well, it's a lovely familiar cover. Corey's a bit disappointed there are no more shots inside the book of you, Kerry.
We wanted baby Kerry and teenage Kerry.
Well, baby Kerry and teenage Kerry photos were wiped out in the 1974 Brisbane floods when my parents' home went under. It literally covered the top of the roof. So all of that kind of memorabilia went. Completely.
Oh, that's tragic. But no reason not to put some nice, more recent photos, the grandkids and...
Well...
837 pages you've got here, Kerry. You could have fitted a couple of each.
All those years in journalism, Corey, I never basically carried a camera. I mean, if the iPhone had been invented 50 years ago, you might have a few more. But did I miss opportunities? You know, I suppose I was just focused on what I was doing and I would have felt a bit of a klutz. Asking Nelson Mandela if he'd pose for a photo with me.
You paint a wonderful picture. This is a book that every journalist, young or old, should read. It's also a wonderful history of post-World War II Australia because, of course, it begins with your birth. You were born into the, 1945, 1946. So that was where it begins. So it's a wonderful history of our country for the last half a century or more. But it's also a great book about journalism and a great book about the ABC, which, of course, is the topic on everyone's lips at the moment. So we'll talk about it a bit more, Corrie, in BSF.
We will, Caro. We've got a bit of, as usual, housekeeping to do and a little bit of feedback. The Insta account, which is no longer Caro and Corrie, everyone, so stop following that one. Remember, I lost the password. It's Don't Shoot Pod, so it's @Don't Shoot Pod. Lots of comments on your race gear. because I put up a photograph of Brendan and yourself.
With the controversial hairband.
Yes. Stroud underscore Lulu says, a headband, looking good, girlfriend. And, of course, we received lots of lovely comments about last week's episode with Annabelle Crabb, our guest. Jill James on Facebook said, so good, my two favourite podcasts brought together. And, of course, she was referring to Annabelle's and Lee Sale's wonderful podcast, Chat 10 Looks 3. And a very big welcome to a few chatterers who have come across and have discovered us. Welcome to the panel, ladies and gentlemen. And also on Instagram, at Shemozzle said, this is just like when Richard Feidler interviewed Ira Glass, a complete podsgram. And now, Carrie, you wouldn't know who Ira Glass is, but he is the most wonderful host of This American Life. I'm not sure.
I love This American Life is the only podcast I knew about before we did this one, Corrie.
Caro, also just on housekeeping too, a reminder that our special podcast lunch at the Flying Duck in Prahran is now booked out. We'd like to thank our sponsors, the Interchange Bench and also the Flying Duck, and all of our Don't Shoot the Messengers who have gotten behind this wonderful Breast Cancer Network of Australia cause. We have sold out, Potties. How popular are we?
Well done, girls, and well done to the Interchange Bench and to the Flying Duck Hotel and to you, Corrie, for putting it together. Now, I just want to echo the words of our friend John Sylvester, the Sunday Age journalist, who commented recently that what happened in Melbourne last Friday was a great tragedy. And Brendan and I have, for many years, as you probably have too, Corrie, eaten, drunk coffee, bought those wonderful, what are they?
Paninis.
At Pellegrini's restaurant. And when I found out on Saturday that it was Dear Sisto who had been murdered by the terrorist who attacked that crazy guy who attacked Melbourne again last Friday. It was just such a terrible shock. And I can't think of a better person to deserve a state funeral. And state funerals don't happen as a matter of course, ever. And there have been some mistaken state funerals, some overplayed state funerals.
I always wondered whether Ted Whitten should have received a state funeral.
There's a story behind that we'll talk about another day. But anyway, John Sylvester made the point that in the end, Melburnians came out of this so well, I felt, and the fact that people ran towards that burning car and not away from it, and the fact that Sisto himself died, we think, because he was going forward to help the man who he thought was in trouble. And I've spoken to people who've worked in shops around there, and I think what happened in the days that followed was just so impressive and such a, it sounds corny, but good hopefully did triumph over evil. That doesn't probably help Sisto's family at the moment, all the people who were scared to go to work at that part of Bourke Street. But it was such a true sort of comment, and similar to the Lynn Cafe attack in Sydney, it was a similar thing. And I don't know what more we can say about it, except that I do think it said so much that people from Trolley Guy to Sisto, who tried to prevent something or tried to help and not run away, said so much about our city.
And we're so cohesive here and, as you say, willing to help. Kerry, you've covered so many tragedies as a journalist over your 50-year career. And when things like this happen at home, like the Link Cafe siege and so on, what are your first reactions? I mean, do you kind of go into still journalism mode and become the detached observer? It's very hard not to be involved, isn't it?
Well, the Lynn Cafe one particularly so, because my first thought went to the fact that my son was working about two blocks away. And when it is in your front yard, those kinds of personal connections kick in one way or another. It just becomes that much more personal. It's a weird thing to try and process. And sometimes journalists who've learnt over the years to try and stand back from things and not get personally engaged, and when something actually cuts through that protective space, it just hits you doubly hard.
Yep. No, that's a wonderful point. Did your son get in touch with you?
He did.
Immediately?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So you didn't have too long worrying about it?
No. But people kind of go into protective mode, don't they? It's not like they kind of roll up into a small ball and about protecting themselves, but they're mentally and instinctively they're kind of searching the landscape to make sure that their own loved ones aren't affected. But I was interested to hear you talking about people's instinct to move forward rather than to move backwards. It's a wonderful kind of thing to take away from a really bad moment.
Particularly when, had his plans been carried out, it could have been so much more destructive.
Mm.
Kerry, The ABC, of course, has become the story, and never more so than on Monday night. That was just a riveting four corners.
And sadly, the last one for the year, but boy, have they gone out on a high.
They have gone out on a high. And just to mention a memoir again, I mean, to look back to some of your recollections and to think that there was a time when the 7:30 report had, I mean, almost forgotten that it had state-based programs, and the staff that worked at the ABC and the amount of coverage that went on. I mean, it's just impossible to imagine that ABC now.
Yeah. I mean, part of the problem that the ABC finds itself in is the problem that's besetting all media, and that is the digital transformation that's taking place and the impact that that's having. And the confusion it's creating as people in leadership of the various media institutions try and take stock and work out how they respond to it. I mean, the fact is we are now in an age where all media is meeting in the middle and the various platforms and so on. But I think that the fundamental, while we work out the implications of what this platform means over that platform and as far as print's concerned, you know, at what point do we stop printing newspapers and just rely entirely on the internet to deliver our product? I think we must never, ever, ever lose sight of what is at the heart of it all, and that is the content, and that's particularly so for television and for radio. And I think that the ABC has been in danger at times of forgetting that, and I thought that, and I talk about it in the book, I think that the way Late Line was axed was a very short-sighted decision on the part of ABC management, because that really was, particularly in its early days when it was a single-issue format for a full half hour and you actually had the luxury in television, and time is always the luxury. You had the luxury of spending an entire half hour on a single issue and for once you could actually get below the surface on it. And because of the satellite, we had access to the great minds of the world. You know, we really did roam the world at night, and we're amazed constantly at the kinds of quality people and the best and the brightest who were prepared to actually come on and treat us seriously because we were a serious program. And the public response to that was fantastic. And that's lost.
We talked about this, Corrie, didn't we, when it was axed last year?
We were lamenting it, yes.
It was like losing a wonderful intellectual friend that joined you every night as you were sort of getting ready to go to bed and make your cup of tea. We're going to bring Ford Crush of the Week because we mentioned the Interchange Bench again, Corrie, which sponsors this program, specialists in temporary staffing and executive contracting. Visit interchangebench.com.au. It is a wonderful, wonderful initiative. But, Corrie, something tells me that you might have a non-Crush of the Week, and it does relate to the topic we're about to talk about.
It wasn't hard to find. There was the presence of Michelle Guthrie and Justin Milne on Four Corners on Monday night, and I don't want to detract from Four Corners' success in actually persuading them to come on, but God on earth, what were they thinking? What were their lawyers saying to them? There's litigation caught up in all this, and neither of them walked away from it well, and I just don't know what they thought they were going to achieve. I mean, the bottom line is that if neither of them was prepared to go on, there wouldn't have even been a program, and they wouldn't have been worse off as they are now. I don't think either of them was convincing, and I just wonder how much in their thoughts was the fundamental, you know, their concern for the great institution of public broadcasting, the ABC.
You mentioned earlier about the digital world being the new way forward for the ABC. Sometimes content has been overlooked. Michelle Guthrie's credentials, of course, were very much part of this. That was why she was brought on board. She'd had the experience with Google and then earlier with Rupert Murdoch's organisation. Was it seen as a good appointment at the time?
Well, look, I basically left pretty much as she arrived, so I can't talk personally about it. But I've had my insights from others who still work in the place, and also what I've absorbed in the media myself. Nobody would deny that the ABC faces a massive challenge, as it has been doing now for about the last decade, in terms of managing and getting through the impact of the digital age. It's one thing to come in with an agenda for change. But if you are going to significantly shake up the whole structure of that complex beast which is the ABC, then you'd better also have the capacity to bring the staff with you and to be able to explain to them the rationale behind what you're doing. And I think it's pretty clear, even from Michelle Guthrie's performance last night. No, I'm not kicking someone while they're down. I thought the way that whole process of her departure was handled was appalling. But she does have to look in the mirror and face up to the question of whether she was really up to the mark as a leader, implementing enormous change which was affecting every life in the place, as well as its very large and very loyal audience base. And I think she fell short of the mark. But then, of course, you come to the issue of the board and its chair. And we can make a clear judgment about Justin Mills' position because he resigned too. And there is now the question of whether the board of the board's situation and all this. But fundamentally, with such a hostile government in play, with these endless inquiries that keep being thrown at the ABC, with the rounds of budget cut after budget cut, and the sniping and the complaints going on endlessly. It's just an outrage to me and shows a deep insensitivity to how highly regarded the ABC is in the broad Australian community, including many of this government's own constituents.
Kerry, Corrie, I found it hard to believe a word either of them were saying. I mean,
neither was a credible witness.
No, but I mean, obviously, often the truth in your own mind is the truth and you don't really remember what the real truth is. But there were so many times when I found Michelle's testimony to what happened, I mean, they were so diametrically opposed for a start. I found it hard to believe Justin Milne's insistences that he hadn't spoken to key politicians, Malcolm Turnbull down. I found it so hard to believe her version of events on several issues. And then out of the blue came the Me Too moment of the hand on the back at Billy Quong's at the dinner. I mean, was that something that was well known among ABC staff before it was revealed on Monday night?
Well, just remember that I'm a couple of steps back from it all.
I know.
I'd certainly heard nothing along those lines. And it seems to me it came as a surprise to many people, including, given their response, the board, the other board members who were at the dinner, which doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No.
We're just in no position to judge. And you don't walk away from that Four Corners program feeling any confidence that you can make judgments about what you believe and what you don't believe from either of those two protagonists. It's a very unfortunate situation, and the ABC and its staff do not deserve it.
Kerry, one of the telling points on he said, she said, and it reminded me a bit of most excellent coverage after Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, after Gillard rolled Rudd, and the ABC did terrific coverage on that, and you're listening to all sides talk about the same event, you know, what happened in the room. And the other night they were talking about, Sarah Ferguson asked them about the proposed sacking of Emma Alberici.
Mm.
And Milne said, when asked did Guthrie take part in discussions about Alberici, Milne said, absolutely. And Guthrie said, no.
Mm.
You can't really go anywhere unless
there is some other corroborative evidence for one or other of them. I mean, I suppose it's like two people in a courtroom vehemently in opposition to what the other is, contradictory of what the other is saying, and then it gets down to trying to work out, well, who is the more believable of the two, and that's where you struggle.
And at this stage, there's no new chairman. There's only an acting chairman. David Anderson, of course, is the acting CEO. We're not going to know until February, March next year who is going to be, in fact, leading the ABC. It's a very, very unattractive set of circumstances, but the people who've come out of this, well, Sarah Ferguson's come out of, she would have been better off running the ABC, I reckon, after watching the other night.
She did say it was the strangest assignment she'd ever had. She said that at the beginning of the show. Mm. Would you have agreed with that, Kerry, if you'd been given that brief?
Well, I interviewed Jonathan Shire in the 7:30 era and my 7:30 era. And
you write really well about his era too in the book. But
yes, well, there was certainly plenty to work with. Jonathan Shire, for those who don't remember, was appointed managing director of the ABC by a board that had been significantly set in place by the Howard government. Donald MacDonald was the chair of the board. He was a good friend of John Howard's. Michael Kroger was on the board. He was a good friend of Peter Costello's. Jonathan Shire set about implementing the changes that he thought were necessary in the place, but to the staff, it was a little bit like watching a bull in a china shop. And to the extent that we fundamentally disagreed with many of the things he was seeking to do, and as he was sacking staff, he was expanding the senior management and extensively. So while there was a big redundancy bill and people were personally suffering as they walked out the door, there were all these new managers running around the place who were swelling the executive salaries no end. But even, I think, five of his 12 hand-picked senior executives had either been sacked or had walked within 12 months. And so there was enormous instability in the place. And accurately or not, there were widely held assumptions that he was acting on a brief from those anti-ABC forces inside the government who wanted to see the culture ripped up. And so to actually have him on the program, given that he was making rather hostile and for some people intimidating comments about what he thought of the 7:30 report, and by implication me, and I was reading stories with headlines that said "dead man talking," and my boss Paul Williams, who was the head of news and current affairs, was "dead man walking." We're both doing quite well, thank you very much. That was a strange experience, but so you work out when you avoid the sense of self-indulgence by walking the straight line, by treating it like any other story, or in my case, any other interview, and then you know that you're judged by the audience. Yes. There you judge.
Can I just send a cheerio and a thank you to the Interchange Bench? If your business needs new players, pick them up from the Interchange Bench, the leading provider of temporary and contract talent. See interchangebench.com.au. You will not find Kerry O'Brien sitting there on the bench because he's very happily retired now in Byron Bay. Half your luck, Kerry. But for talent so good, you'd wish you can keep them. Call the Interchange Bench. And that was Kerry O'Brien's non-crush of the week. We're playing with the format here a bit. But yes, as you said, let's skip on to books. Kerry, your most wonderful AIM memoir, $44.99, published by Allen and Unwin. You're a Queensland boy, one of four children to Lotta and Jack, to whom you actually dedicate the book. And your first job is as a filing clerk in the Queensland Public Curator's Office. That sounds like the most boring job, almost as boring as when I worked at The Age in their photo sales department when I was 15, just cutting up negatives and putting them in plastic bags.
I still have a suspicion that the ambience around you might have been a little more exciting than mine.
But when did the journalism bug bite and why?
Well, look, it had been kind of hanging in the background, but my father desperately wanted me to be a lawyer. The rather whimsical vocational guidance person who roamed through our school briefly and said, what are you good at? And I said, well, I'm not bad at English. And he said, well, you could either be a journalist or a school teacher, and wafted off. So I applied for a cadetship at the Courier Mail and at the ABC, and neither were interested, and I don't blame them. I was 17 and probably looked about 12, and did not have a great school history. I was certainly not a very attentive student, and nor was I a very good student as far as the brothers were concerned. But my father, after giving up on the law, and my mother expressing her horror at the possibility that I might end up as a plumber, sorry plumbers, he rang an old mate of his who had been a Sydney Morning Herald correspondent in New Guinea in the war. Harry Summers was his name. But he'd become a rather meek and mild old guy, a bachelor, who actually got me entree to do weekend work at Channel 9 in Brisbane. I was about 20 by then. Had really lost my way. I was really drifting. And walked through the doors of the Channel 9 newsroom. I think there were four full-time journalists, maybe five at the time. And my main job was listening to the illegal police radio. And I just loved the idea that I was allowed to do something illegal for a start. And it was magic, you know, the adrenaline of it. You just picked up off everyone else's adrenaline. I got caught up in the chase and the hunt and the competition with your rivals and watching stuff go to air and looking at the at the way people work together to produce the product and just the overall excitement of it. Harry Summers' advice to my father a year or so later, when I'd already become very restless and turned my eyes south of the border to Sydney. And Dad asked Harry what he thought about this, and Harry said, "Oh, Jack, don't let him go. It's a jungle down there." And I look back and I think, this poor bugger spent serious time in New Guinea with the Japanese, one of the worst parts of the whole of the Second World War, telling people that Sydney was a jungle.
Well, the book, you navigate through, there's a lot of humour, starting with the first line, really, and insisting that your hair is real and you were born that way and no wig. And did women really come up to you? Did a journalist really actually inspect your hair roots?
Absolutely she did. The killer tomato.
I reckon I've been a pretty good journalist and a tough journalist at times, but I cannot imagine going up to someone and, A, not believe, as you said, well, I think you've got lovely hair. But,
oh, thank you, Caroline.
But I do think
I did that once to Phyllis Diller because she was actually wearing a wig. And she made a comment about the wig and I said, "Oh, that's your real hair." And she said, "Honey, come and touch it." And I pulled it and I almost pulled the wig off. So, look, you are sometimes allowed to touch people's hair.
And there are moments of great sadness. I mean, your regret over not having that final cup of coffee with Andrew Olley before his death after you got the job that perhaps he would have expected, taking over the National 7:30 report.
Yeah.
Much, much sadder, the loss of your dear brother, Tony.
Paul.
Paul, I'm sorry.
That. Tony's still going.
And wonderful stories about your brothers all the way through, but obviously in his battle with mental illness and your parents' great sadness about that. I mean, there's so much sadness and so much happiness in this book. As a journalist, what left me really, I suppose not regret is the wrong word, but your utter frustration towards the end of getting anything intelligent or meaningful out of politicians in interviews. It's just so disappointing, isn't it? And if someone like you, and you said even when you had 25 minutes at times, you felt frustrated. But in the end, and now they use the sound bites, don't they, the time to get their message across.
So many aspects to this, Caroline. I mean, the 24-hour churn and the way politicians are constantly learning and seeking and working out ways to exploit. I don't mind politicians working out the most effective way to use the media if they're talking about communicating policy and if they're having genuine political debates on important issues rather than just sniping at each other or just working out the message of the day. But the latter is more likely than the former. And it really had become Groundhog Day for me by the time I walked away from 7:30. And it's a sad, sad comment on the state of politics, not just here, but throughout the democratic world. And there's a lot going on that we need to be concerned about. Somebody asked, or several people have asked me, knowing that I'd interviewed Obama, how I'd go about interviewing Donald Trump. And I have I don't think for a second in answering that, I wouldn't touch that interview with a barge pole. I would not consider it for a second. What would be the point? I mean, the man is not only a thug, he is a deeply divisive human being. He exploits issues like racism to the hilt. He's very much a reflection of that kind of shock jock approach to life, which is that you look for those areas where you can divide rather than unite. Divide and rule, black and white, everything's simple, there are no complexities. And the man just lies in his teeth. Why would you bother doing an interview with somebody like that? Because it would only be for the spectacle. You know, and by your second question he's shouting at you, and by the third question he's ordering you out. I mean, what's the point?
Kerry, you have so many recollections of interesting, extraordinary and less interesting conversations with politicians. But one of the chapters I love, given my love of the celebrity, is the chapter called Real Celebrity. And you reflect on the interviews and you've actually incorporated some of the dialogue between yourself and people like Nelson Mandela and Bruce Springsteen, Tim Winton, Michael Palin. There's a cast of thousands. And it's one of my favourite chapters, actually, when you go off script, which is the script off we beast. Know. Well, we know that you're – yeah, exactly. We know that you're Kerry O'Brien, you know, the hard-hitting political interviewer. But these were such tender moments. That change of pace when you had the opportunity, what did that afford you as a journalist?
Well, for a start, they were the things that kept me sane and kept me going at 7:30 for longer than I otherwise might have. And the reason I called it Real Celebrity is because there is so much bullshit celebrity in the world. And this is real celebrity in the sense that it is, we're talking about people who are to be celebrated because they have done things worthy of celebration. So they are real celebrities. And I suppose what I've tried to do, looking at that ray, that kind, quite eclectic range of people across the arts, the writers, the performers, the singers, the comedians, and the scientists. I mean, people like Oliver Sacks. I mean, God.
You have a lovely section there where you reflect on death, which is in the middle of the book, not at the end, which is what most autobiographers do. And you refer to Oliver Sacks' view on this. And I found that an incredibly moving, and it almost was, given your strong family Catholic background, it was almost religious, actually, in a way. I felt that was a terrific couple of pages.
He was such an impressive character. He had such an imagination, very bright man, but such humanity. And I interviewed him, I think, five times over the years. I interviewed him for Late Line and I interviewed him again for 7:30, and I would have interviewed him every year if I could have. And his books, you know, this man was a psychiatrist dealing with mental illness, but managing to make it vivid. And he was seeing merit where other people saw reasons to ostracize or be fearful of. He saw wonderful things. He saw attributes that no other people saw, and he wrote about them brilliantly. So I loved interviewing him, and that was the point. I mean, I can remember interviewing James Taylor, and his minders had wanted me to interview him with Carole King because they were coming out to do a concert together. And, of course, the only reason I got access to a lot of these people was because they wanted to promote why they were here, whether it was a book, a film, or a concert. And I said, well, actually, I interviewed Carole King a few years ago. I'd rather just interview James Taylor. No, no, you must do them both. And I said, well, I'm terribly sorry. They came back and said, okay, well, you can have James, but you can't talk about drugs. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I haven't even begun to think what I'll talk about, but you can't restrict it like that. So if that's what it has to be, I'll pass again. So they came back and said, yes, you can interview him. And he raised the drugs before I did. Wonderful, wonderful interview. In my terms, I loved it because he was so candid, so evocative, so articulate. And this is a guy who, in the mid Beatles days, as a young musician, he walks through the door of, was it Apple Studios in London, Abbey Road, and he's in the next studio recording while the Beatles are recording next door, and occasionally they come in and play with him. But he was also a depressive and he was self-medicating, and one of his self-medications was heroin. And we talked about that, and he articulated how debilitating it became for him, and how his world shrank to the point where he felt like he was on the head of a pin, that he was so small. And he was using this kind of terminology, and he was explaining why drugs in the end for him were a giant negative, and that he was amazed that he'd survived. And at the end, he shook my hand warmly. And I thought, how silly for these people to be so defensive about this stuff. But, you know, those interviews, one of the patterns that comes out when you go back after a long time and you look at all these things, one pattern that emerged was the number of these people who suffered depression to one degree or another, the number of them who self-medicated. Robin Williams, what a beautiful man, and what an extraordinarily talented man. But again, sits down in the room and he gives. He gives. Yes, he's there to promote a concert. But I found that when they saw that you'd come prepared and you were reflecting, I hope, thoughtfulness in the questions, they soon mostly relaxed into it and suddenly you're having a real conversation. Those were the things I enjoyed.
Before we continue, BSF Corrie, I just refer everyone to page 773 and that incredibly prophetic interview with Malcolm Turnbull the first time around, basically talking about why Kevin Rudd failed and how he left with nothing. And you could insert Malcolm Turnbull with Kevin Rudd in that interview. It is just unbelievable how the lack of self-awareness by Malcolm Turnbull is just remarkable. And on a personal note, your piece, and it's amazing he's still alive because I felt he was going to die any minute in the show. But the special you did with Clive James, it's one of the great pieces of television I've ever seen. And you, if you want to understand Clive James and his history and his writing, clearly there was a deep personal connection there. It was just wonderful.
It was a very laboured thing to do because we did it over 6 hours. We recorded not much more than an hour. We recorded an hour and a half, and the whole hour and a half should have gone to air. An hour went to air, but it took 6 hours because of his emphysema and his various other ailments. He's permanently on serious drugs for... he had leukemia, amongst other things. And, of course, he's been predicting his imminent death for about 4 years now.
And he's still
including that interview. And I felt we were in the middle of a requiem with him still living. But and certainly the laboured way he was getting around and his breathing and his energy. You know, he had very low energy. But what incredible honesty
about the victims of his own brilliance, really, that he'd left behind.
Yes, and he's talking about fame and television and the mask that hides the face. A great way with words, wonderfully read, an autodidact, and he's obsessively writing this poetry now, which is being very widely acclaimed by serious critics. And one day... One day, hopefully not for a long while, but one day he'll actually die. And we'll all be surprised because we've got so used to him predicting it for so long.
Thank God the ABC does have a digital department. Thank you, Michelle Guthrie, for that, because we can all access those wonderful interviews and also that great series you did with Paul Keating, who popped up on my television set last night on the 7:30.
He has a habit of doing that, doesn't he?
It's like Father Christmas comes again. You just go, there you are.
No, it's like tap, tap, I'm still here. Watch out.
Now, Corrie, you're going to tell us about the series Tour of Victoria, which started on the ABC.
Super quick, Kerry, I'm sure you and Sue are tuning into this one when you get a spare night together when you're not on book tour. Look, I love Saturday Night at Home with the ABC, and of course I was looking forward to Doc Martin, yet another repeat, but who cares? Poured the glass of wine and thought, what's on? And of course it was
Port Wen, no?
Well, I was off to Victoria in England, and this is the second series, and it was the second show. So, of course, I then, you know, did the ABC iView thing and watched the first one. This second series of Victoria once again stars the beautiful Jenna Coleman, who I think is way too beautiful to be playing Queen Victoria because she was a bit of a, frumpy old thing toward the end there, and Tom Hughes as Albert. And, of course, the wonderful Rufus Sewell, who I have a big crush on, plays Lord Melbourne, somewhat convincingly, unconvincingly. That's for the critics to decide. But, of course, the whole...
My mother insists he's far too young for Lord
Melbourne.
Far too
young. That's exactly
time.
Right, yep. But still a great actor. But this one is, to set it up for series two, she says to Melbourne at one stage, to be a queen, I must rule, yet to be a wife, it seems, I must submit. And this is the sort of the tenor of series two. She's having children. Almost every episode there's a new child arrives. And, of course, Albert is still trying to find his role. What is his role here and what's his contribution that he can make to the greater British good? It's a terrific series. I commend it highly. It does get a bit schmaltzy at times with the love scenes. But if he drops to his knee one more time and kisses her hand and tells her how much he loves her, I think I'll just probably throw a slipper at the television. But it is a great show. 7:30 ABC Saturday nights. That is Victoria. And, Caro, you have your curry recipe.
She has to be one of the more fascinating characters of the last 200 or 300 years, Queen Victoria, and they keep reinventing her. And some of the books, including the most recent one by the Australian author, Julia...
bed
is just
fabulous.
Brilliant.
Anyway, she was a brilliant strategist, actually, Queen Victoria. All the marriages and mixing all the bloodlines of Europe. She was very smart at that.
And can I just very boldly interrupt before the curry? But the second time I interviewed Margaret Thatcher, she'd written her autobiography, and she talked. She wanted to return England to Victorian times. She pined for the days of the vigorous virtues, as she called them, where unmarried mums were kept in institutions run by churches, and their childs were looked after for them while they were forced out to work to earn their keep. And she pined for the return to those days, and away from the times when all those nasty homeless people who'd been thrown out of work because of her reforms and were expecting some kind of welfare payment.
I'll just grab my jet beads now and ring them around my neck. Well,
this is from yet another book, one of our favourites, the Monday Morning Cooking Club, that wonderful group of Sydney women who've put out a few cookbooks now. This is from their first one, Corrie. It's their South Indian fish curry. All the ingredients and steps will be in the show notes, but this is one you can make in advance. You make the coconut milk base, which you cook, and that involves tomato, coconut milk, etc., garlic and onion, and you make a paste, both of which you can do in the Nutribullet or the Maggi mix. You can do it the day before. 750 grams of good firm white fish. I use ling fillets. The actual cooking process takes about less than half an hour. These are the spices and curry ingredients you will need. Fernacreek, brown mustard seeds, ground cumin, ground coriander and turmeric.
You did all of that without looking at your notes.
I've made it twice in the last week.
Oh, my lordy, you're
good.
To
much acclaim, and it serves six, and it'll all be in the show notes. Use light coconut milk. It is an absolute winner. And I'm going to move on to grumpy straight away. I'll tell you what I'm grumpy about. What has happened to our society that it's too much of an effort to vote on actual election day? I think to bring forward this voting to 2 weeks before the actual election just doesn't feel right to me. For a start, we've got this Greens candidate who is an absolute nutter. If you listen to some of the rap tunes he was putting out a few years ago.
We're talking Victorian politics here. Potties from, yeah. And Kerry from yeah. Interstate.
Yeah, but I mean,
She's on a rant. I dare not engage in
I that. Used to love the collegiate atmosphere of Election Day. I mean, people are saying, oh, but it's such an effort to get out on a Saturday and vote on that day. What if I understand postal voting. I understand you going away. I even understand a week before the election. But 2 weeks before, it is ridiculous.
Nance, can I just say, while you were swanning around doing your Ollie lecture up in Sydney, we did actually discuss this particular issue with Anna from the Oppie and
her
husband, Brendan.
Now.
And we all lamented, like, why can't you just go down to the local primary school and have your sausage and away you go.
Sure, you've got a view on this, Kerry.
Well, I would just remind those people who complain about the fact that we have compulsory voting that they don't have compulsory voting in America and they've got Donald Trump.
Exactly. My point. Rah, rah, compulsory voting. I couldn't agree more. Kerry, you and I could go off and have a drink and discuss this further.
Okay.
We've got a few quick questions, six actually, and Caro, your first one is to Kerry.
Oh, I just want to ask about the sea change and living in Byron Bay. Has it been a good move?
Absolutely.
And can we come to it?
Anytime. We had been talking about it for a while. We were both at a stage in our lives. Sue was a journalist. And we'd both reached the stage pretty much at the same point where we wanted out of Sydney. We wanted to walk away from the structured existence we were leading. We wanted to give ourselves a chance to freshen up a bit and maybe think of other things. And we had we'd worn a path to Queensland via Byron over many years because both our parents and family were up there. We had friends there. That seemed an obvious place to think about, easy commuting. We've been there 8 years now and we've never had a moment's regret. I mean, most of our kids are in Sydney.
Kerry, it's Caro and my dream. We love Byron Bay. In fact, I shouldn't say that too loudly because everybody will want to go and live there.
Brunswick Heads, New Brighton, Cabarita, that whole area.
We do see a lot of Victorians. They mostly have a smile on their faces.
How funny that.
Well, I spotted can't... you in Espresso Head having a coffee or a breakfast and been desperate to come up and introduce myself, but haven't.
Well, now you won't be able to hide.
But I love I the bet fact you get that a lot of it. You've gone up there to relax and you've written an 800-plus page book.
But that was part of the process of working out what we really wanted to do. And, I mean, I did the Keating In those 5 years when we first went up there, so I was commuting weekly to Sydney to do Four Corners. When I say do Four Corners, my contribution was small compared to what the others were doing. But in that period, I started and really completed the Keating project as the interview series and then the book. And that kind of opened the way in my mind to seriously consider what became this memoir. And while it's been a big challenge and it's taken all of my efforts of discipline, something I certainly didn't have in my early years, that still means that I've got a nicely unstructured life around that existence. And if I choose to write between 3 and 7 in the morning and do something else during the day, well, I can do that. And so I think that Sue and I have found a really nice space.
Oh, we're coming to visit you. Next question to you, Caro. TV personality Karl Stefanovic is hiring a personal reputation manager. Good move or bad move?
I think if you're going to hire a personal reputation manager, no one should know about it. The fact that we know about it tells me that it's a really bad move. It's like when you hire a public relations advisor and they're standing there and everyone knows you've got him. They're meant to be a secret. Dumb. Corrie, can you explain the great Bunnings sausage sizzle drama?
Yeah, look, it's come out that Bunnings are now watching all of those community groups that hold a sausage sizzle outside their Bunnings every weekend to make sure that they put the onions under the sausage instead of on top, because apparently when the onions are on top, they slip out of the roll and there is a health hazard to people who may slip on it and break some bone in their body.
To everyone whose husband comes home from Bunnings and doesn't seem as hungry as they should be for lunch.
Well, the onion clearly is on
Kerry's got his hand up.
The onion clearly is on the footpath somewhere. Kerry, of all the celebrities you've interviewed, and most of whom do, as I said, receive a special mention in your memoir, who would you most like to sit next to at a dinner party?
Well, a lot of them, really. I'd want to put a few of them together, but I actually once expressed this view, Bette Midler.
Oh, yes, we love Bette. I'd be there too, in Byron Bay.
Well, it was just, she was wonderful. And again, so often these people come with a whole retinue of minders, and she seemed to have a lot of women in pinstripe suits milling around. And despite the fact that they were keen to get her on to her next thing, we spoke for about 20 minutes before we even got round to the interview. And then as soon as the interview was over, we were straight back into another deep conversation. And she's got a lot of things to say that are interesting. Very bright, very well-informed, very engaged woman. And I just thought in that moment, and I almost did it, and I wish I had, it would have been an inevitable knockback simply because of the way their lives are structured. But I just thought for one moment what a great idea it would be to say to her, if you really want to meet and engage with some Australians, why don't I just throw a small discreet dinner party and invite, say, 8
Caro
people.
Caro and Corrie.
Yes,
you
that's right.
Have.
I know I should have, and I didn't, and it's a mild regret. And the answer probably would have been no, but would have been nice to have done, wouldn't it?
Oh, you never know.
I thought you were going to say you wanted to break out into song with her and sing "You Are the Wings Beneath My Wings."
One of my favourite lines of hers is when she said to Jack Nicholson, when she had that TV show, "You must come on my show." And Jack Nicholson said, "I don't do television." And she said, "Jack, you don't do television yet." And I'll ask you the least. Who would you least like at the dinner party?
Oh, Donald Trump.
But you haven't interviewed him.
No. Oh, I see. Of those I've interviewed.
Yes.
Well, that's a hard one. God, who was the guy? He was directing Black Hawk Down, but he'd done Blade Runner, director.
Oh, Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott. I interviewed Ridley Scott. And again, he was looking for a sort of patsy interview to promote Black Hawk Down. And there was some controversy about it, which I pursued in my own gentle way. And he didn't like that at all. Because it related to allegations or suggestions that he had manipulated things, he'd manipulated the facts in a way that suited what he wanted out of the film. But there was a kind of sense of entitlement, not just crankiness, but sense of entitlement and arrogance that to me came through that left me feeling fine about ending the interview.
I wouldn't want to have dinner with him. Caro, I have a GLT, which I just want to share very quickly. All your roses are coming out now, Potties. Your gardens look amazing. And then, of course, come the middle of January and early February, it's looking a bit tired. It is okay to prune again, a summer prune, and then you get an early autumn blush, Caro. So I would just be suggesting, after the first flush of brooms, deadhead, remove dead wood, shape the bush, give it a prune. And if you're not sure what to do, I found a rather charming chap called Curtis Smith, who is an American horticulturist. He has a YouTube on how to prune roses in summer. There you go. Thank you, Kerry, for joining us today for our funny little Don't Shoot the Messenger. It seems so small compared to your vast career. But
oh, rubbish. Rubbish.
It's been an absolute treat. I've enjoyed it. Thank you. And the book is too.
Yes, well. Kerry O'Brien, a memoir. As I said, $44.99 at all good bookstores near you, including my own bookshop, which Kerry has visited with your friend and our friend Kate.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us, everybody. I do have to put in a bit of a plug for episode 4 of the Book Pod, where I interview journalist, feminist and writer Anne Summers. Boy, oh boy, it was that a fun hour and a bit. And there's a bit of naughty blue talk at the end of it too, which I didn't realise Jane was taping. Please subscribe to the Book Pod, everyone. And also please share Don't Shoot the Messenger with your friends and tell your family and friends, of course, to join us. Your word of mouth recommendations and your ratings are the best publicity ever. And for details of everything that we've discussed on the show and how to get in touch with us, check out the show notes in your podcast app. Thanks again, Kerry. All the best with your tour. Hope the voice gets better. And, Caro, what do we say?
Don't shoot the messenger, Corrie.
Thanks to both of you.
Hi, I'm Anne Summers. I hope you can join Corrie Perkin and I on the Book Pod. There's definitely a new wave. We've gone from that period during the 90s of I'm not a feminist, but now everyone's a feminist. And it maybe it's diluted. What do you mean by that? I mean, if Rihanna and Beyonce and every politician you can think of is calling themselves a feminist, what does that mean and what do they mean when they say that? And this to me was the most extraordinarily glamorous and sophisticated thing, you know, that I could possibly imagine. And the notion that a single woman had the money and the freedom to do something like that was, you know, it just opened my eyes, and it made me realise that I wasn't bound to the choices that my family and that my school had tried to impose on me, and I realised there were other ways.
So Don Watson, your mate, rings up. He's acting as speechwriter for Paul Keating, the then Prime Minister, and says, Paul's got a bit of a problem with women. I love that. We do love the way Don talks.
And the lawyers tried to take that out. They're saying, you know, that we don't want to imply that Paul Keating is sexually harassing or something. I said, no one's going to think that. I mean, it's quite obvious.
We get it, because it's the way Australians talk.
Yes.
And also, if you know Don Watson,
and
you know
Paul Keating. And also, the context is quite clear. We're talking about a political problem. We're talking about a gender gap. I'm Anne Summers. Join me on the Book Pod. Subscribe to the Book Pod wherever you can listen to podcasts.